Morning, everybody. Well, I can't see it real well, but judging by the size of the crowd for second service, I'm guessing one of two things happened. You either remembered it was a 3:25 start, or you sold your tickets for the day, one of the two. I had a fellow stop by my office on Friday before I left the building for the day, a friend of mine, and he asked me, "So what are you doing this weekend?" I said, "Well, actually, I'm speaking at my church." And he said, "What about?" Anxiety and depression. I don't think he connected with that very well because he went exactly like this. "Well, those Packers are pretty depressing. And if they don't win this weekend, I don't think even Elijah can help them." So I don't think he was connecting too much with what I was talking about. Over the last few weeks, we have been looking at this prophet Elijah. And we have seen how God did work in Elijah so that God could do work through Elijah. We also saw that Elijah gave us a really a thought-provoking challenge, I guess is a good way to say it. He challenged us and he said, "Who will you serve? Will you serve false gods or the one true God?" And last week we learned from Elijah what it was like to live a life filled with big, bold prayers. Now, today, we're going to wrap up our study of Elijah by looking at a transformational story. Through a deeply challenging series of events, we're going to see how Elijah's focus changed, how he lost fellowship, and how eventually he was fully restored. And I want to remind you, we've referenced this verse quite often, James 5:17, where it tells us that Elijah was a man just like us. His nature was just like us. So I want to caution you today that as we look at these stories, please don't try to put Elijah in a place that you can't relate to. God's word is very clear to say his nature was just like our nature, struggled with the same things we struggle with. And in comparison, he was very much just like you and I. Now, if you're anything like me from Sunday to Sunday, I can forget things. You forget things. And if you say you don't, I don't believe you. Right? We forget things from Sunday to Sunday. So let me do kind of a quick recap of what we have talked about over these last three Sundays. First of all, there is a very evil king and queen over Israel at this time when we're looking at Elijah, Ahab and Jezebel. Ahab married Jezebel to increase his kingdom, but he got more than he could bargain for because one of the things that Jezebel did was she brought Baal worship into the kingdom of Israel. As you can imagine, this was quite displeasing to God. However, what's interesting to me is that had no effect on Ahab or Jezebel. They were so evil and so deceived that they never considered the consequences of their behavior. Didn't faze them at all. We know that Ahab and Jezebel have killed many, if not most, of the prophets of Israel. But Elijah is left alive. And now they are seeking his life. We also saw in chapter 18, the one previous to what we're going to look at today, that Elijah was this powerful, faithful leader, a man of prayer who exhibited just incredible bravery right in the face of his adversaries, looked them literally in the eye. And in the world's eyes, and everything that we read for a backdrop on the story, Elijah had every reason to fear Ahab and Jezebel. They had one goal in mind, to end his life. They were powerful. They were well-resourced, they had no opposition, and they were seeking to kill Elijah. We learned about this incredible, powerful showdown between God and Baal, between the two altars, and the sacrifice that happened. How miraculous was this? And again, there was every logical reason why it should not have worked. Water and fire... don't work together. They don't work together. And yet, God did make it work, and he made it work mightily. We also see at the end of chapter 18, that Elijah took the lives, killed 450 prophets of Baal. The power of God in this story makes itself so evident. In fact, this action that happened on Mount Carmel was literal and it was figurative. It was literal in the sense that it really happened there, but it was also figurative in the sense of God demonstrating his incredible power to his followers and to unbelievers alike. There was like this spiritual high that they were riding. Now we come to chapter 19, and things change quite a bit. We see that Elijah goes from being this brave, faith-filled man of prayer to a fear-filled runner and deserter. Let's look at the first verses of 1 Kings 19. Now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done. Sidebar, I'll throw this in for free. Listen, did you notice that Ahab told Jezebel what Elijah had done, not what God had done? Very telling. And how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them, the prophets of Baal, by tomorrow about this time." And he stood his ground and he was ready for fight. No. And he was afraid and ran for his life. After everything that Elijah had seen God do, at the drop of a few words from a woman, he is turned into a fearful man. Think about this. He holds this young boy in his hands, the widow's son, and he says, "Lord, don't let it be this guy's time. Please heal him." And he stretches himself out over the boy, and the boy is restored. Folks, if we had no other story of Elijah than that, we would all say, "Wow, restored a dead boy to life." Through Elijah's obedience to God, through Elijah's faithfulness to God, he brought about the end of the drought. And of course, we just talked about this incredible showdown with Baal. And yet, again, one word from this evil woman, the queen, paralyzes him, defeats him, and sends him into fearfulness. It's pretty clear to see that from 18 to 19, Elijah's focus has changed. Elijah stood face to face, just like I'm looking at you right now, David, just face to face, just like that, with the false prophets and with Ahab. He looked the enemy of God in the eye, destroyed their temple, showed who his God was, and yet these words begin questions of doubt in his heart, and fear takes over his faith. Elijah began to walk by sight and not by faith. He allowed his circumstances to outgrow his faith. Think about this. He had faith to believe the most ridiculous things. Raising people from the dead. Ending a 3-year drought. Seeing an altar burned that was soaking wet with fire that did not come from his hand, but from above. God prevailed. Elijah was living with big faith. Then, the threatening words of Jezebel sends his faith into a tailspin. His faith changed on that day to focus on his circumstances, and he surrendered to big fear. Now, as we're wont to do, before we look at this guy Elijah, and what a weak man. Before we start pointing the finger at Elijah, let's take a look at us. If victory in the Christian's life comes by faith and not by sight, how are we doing with that? 2 Corinthians 5:7 says that we walk by faith and not by sight. Have you had times in your life, perhaps it's right now, where your circumstances seem bigger than your faith? In a room this size with this many people, I'm pretty confident in saying that over the last couple weeks, you have gotten news that you are not ready for. You may be here this morning, and somebody who you have loved for decades looked you in the eye and said, I don't love you anymore. I can't do this. Maybe you got that call from the doctor that none of us want to get, and it has rocked your world. It was November 1976. 15-year-old boy in my living room at my house. And it was unusual that my folks were not home when I got home from school. About 2 hours after being home, the car pulled in, and it was just my dad with my older brothers. And they told me that Mom was sick, really sick. Cancer. 4 months later, she was gone. I tell you that story not so much about me, but I tell you that story because I saw how that news rocked my dad's world. He was never the same since, to his dying day. You may have just experienced a devastating financial loss or news from your children. In the midst of our pain and fear, I don't know why it is, but it seems to me that many of us choose, as Elijah did, to run from God instead of running to God. We don't like pain, do we? We don't like physical pain. We don't like emotional pain. And I think many of us would say that we would do whatever we could to avoid feeling pain. Can we think about something just for a second? How is it that we can trust God for eternity, which is so hard to grasp? We can trust Him for that, but we don't trust Him for our circumstances. How is that? When we live with that kind of mindset, what we're saying is that we believe God is able to provide eternity in heaven with Him, but He is not able to provide for our present painful circumstances. The lessons that we learn in the valley are lessons that will never be learned on the mountaintop. It is in the valley that God has our attention. It is in the times that God takes us or allows us into the valley, into the pain, into the hard times, that His strength is revealed. And He brings us to a place of total dependence upon Him. 2 Corinthians 12:9, and He said to me, God said to Paul, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, Paul says, therefore, I will rather boast about my weakness that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Think about your story. When has your focus changed to the point where your circumstances has outgrown your faith? What was happening in your life at that time? I can tell you for Elijah, there was a lot going on. One of the things that's very clear to us is he was tired. Elijah was tired. the work that he did for that sacrifice showdown was hard physical work. The building of the altar, the slaying of the animals. He was in this thing all the way. Think about, fellas, how many of you have brothers, fellas? Let me see your hands. Okay, so you wrestle with your brothers, right, when you're young. Do you ever let your brother win? No! Never let your brother win. And when you get in there and you are wrestling and you are all in and you're doing everything you can to not lose, are you tired when it's over? Yes! You are exhausted. Elijah gave everything he had in all of the weeks leading up to what we see here. He was tired. At the time that Elijah received this news from Jezebel, he was wiped out. Now, we're not told exactly how much involvement he had in the taking of the life of the 450 prophets of Baal, but I can't imagine they just stood there and took it. Very involved. And by the way, between the end of 18 and the beginning of 19, it says that the rain started. Remember that? The rain started. And when the rain started, Elijah ran ahead of Ahab. 12 miles in the rain. I bring a load of laundry up from the basement and I'm winded. The guy is tired. On top of everything else going on with him, physically, he is tired. When we're tired, it is not unusual for us to make bad choices. We don't think with our usual filters. We don't make good decisions. We can tend to react or overreact. How many of you have ever been hangry? Right? It's been a long day. You walk in the house, and you start grabbing stuff, throwing it in your pie hole because you're so hungry. And you feel great when you're done. No, of course you don't. We don't make good decisions when we're tired. We may not notice when we're in these places. It's not uncommon for us to just keep going about our business and not checking in. But how many of you in the last little while have had somebody say to you, "Man, you look tired"? Other people can see it. Other people experience our tiredness. Have others pointed out to you that you have a sense of sadness about you, or that your temper is getting shorter? Do you find yourself blaming others, complaining a lot, getting defensive when challenged? These are things that we do more often when we're tired. Are you having difficulty concentrating? You might be entering a dangerous time of tired when the red flag is going up. And men, can I just say, this is not a ladies thing. We are not exempt from this. Ours may come out differently. We may be angry. Do you find yourself working more just to work more? Checking out? Gaming? Sports? Are you drinking more than what you normally do, if at all? Do you find that you've gotten more aggressive? How are you doing behind the wheel? Men, it may not come out always in sadness for us, but it's there. And it comes out. So let me ask you, what do you run to? Elijah ran to the wilderness. What is your go-to? Whatever you run to, this much I know, whatever it is, if it isn't filling you spiritually and emotionally, it is emptying you. It is not filling you. I know of a couple recently who is very, very involved in this church body. If I told you their name, you'd know them right away. I'm not going to mention them. But they had to make the conscious decision to step back from their involvement. They were getting tired. They knew it was time to recharge. So we know by what we read and by what we see that Elijah was tired. But he was also afraid. He absolutely was afraid. You know, when we're tired, often our guard is down. Our concentration can be weak. And you know, we end up with a very welcoming environment to be attacked by the enemy. When we are weak, when we are tired, we become a sitting target. He attacks our mind. He feeds us lies. And he leads us to fear every single time. How does he do that? By doubting God. By doubting God. Elijah listened to these empty threats from Jezebel. There was no more power in her threat and those threatening words than there was in the god Baal to do what he promised he would do. No more power. Empty words from an evil, evil queen. And yet, her words moved him to fear and to flight. You see, Elijah knew that Jezebel had killed the prophets of Israel. And she was good to follow through on her threat to do the same with him. And the weight of what he heard, the weight of those words, was heavier than the weight of what he had seen and experienced with God. His fear drove out his faith. While Elijah could have chosen to fight, instead he chose to flight. So we see that his focus had changed. But we also see that as a result of being tired, as a result of being afraid, his focus changed, but we also see that he lost fellowship. As a result of his choice to embrace fear instead of faith, he takes off. They enter the wilderness. He and his servant enter the wilderness. They get to the edge. Elijah says, "You stay here. I am going to run for one full day that way. I'm going to run for a full day that way." As with Carmel, this wilderness is both figurative and literal. It was an actual wilderness, but think about this. Emotionally and spiritually, Elijah was alone in a hopeless, desolate place that lacked life and hope. It was the wilderness. And the isolation of this wilderness served as a prime setting for despair to set in. So God finds him. He's under this juniper tree, big old covering, out in the middle of the wilderness. Elijah says, "Oh God, wasn't that cool? We did such great things together. I can't wait to do more." No. Elijah says, "It is enough. I can't take anymore. I am consumed and overcome with my fear, with my depression, with my loneliness." And he says, "Oh Lord, take my life." Elijah asked God, "Take my life." How far away in chapter 19 from this man that we saw in chapter 18? Who is this guy? How does this happen? When we cut ourselves off from fellowship, we cut ourselves off from the place of encouragement and usefulness and purposefulness, and we are a sitting target for the enemy. Do you know how a lion hunts? A lion? They find the weakling and they separate it out and he goes after it. He finds the weakling, he separates it out and he goes after it. 1 Peter 5:8, "Be of sober spirit. Be on the alert. Your adversary, The devil prowls about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. So let me ask you, what is the wilderness in your life? When you run from God, where do you run to? What is the wilderness in your life? Perhaps you're here this morning and you can relate very well to Elijah. You're tired. You're afraid. You're lonely. You're depressed. And you're ready to give up. Please hear me. The wilderness is no place to set up camp. The wilderness is no place to set up camp. When you are in pain, when you're experiencing depression, remember, the wilderness is an opportunity to ask, what can I get out of this? Instead of asking, how do I get out of this? I think it's really important for us at this point to pause and make some clarifications. There are people here this morning, you may know people like this, who have battled and continue to battle lifelong depression that may be caused by chemical things, physical things. You or they are under a doctor's care. And even though you have good days and you have bad days, you have chosen to stay in the game. Cheer you on. Keep going. Keep going with good self-care. Some of us go through seasons of depression that are caused by circumstances that are temporary and they pass. But in that moment of your circumstances, the pain is big and it's real. And I'm afraid for many of you, you feel like it will never pass. How many times have you said, will this never end? Will this ever change? The weight is more than I can bear. You may believe that no one understands. You may believe that you are alone. Elijah believed that. God, I'm the last one left. God assured him that was not true. He was not alone, and he was not the last one left. Whatever the cause of this depression that you might be experiencing, please don't try to go it alone. Don't try to go it alone. Seek help. If you don't, you are moving yourself closer and closer and closer to being isolated and losing fellowship. Too many have lived without hope for too long and saw no way out. They took their own life. In 2016, nearly 45,000 Americans died by suicide. To put that in perspective, that's more than the city of Nina and Menasha combined. Living without hope. The college where I teach, in one program, in the last several months, three young men saw no hope, ended their life by suicide. Last week in Nina, young high school boy took his life, saw no hope. In kids, our kids, under 18 years old, there has been a 25% increase in boys under 18 attempting or following through on taking their lives. And for girls, 70%. It's your daughters. It's your granddaughters. It's your neighbors. It's your nieces and nephews who walk around every day in such darkness. They don't see hope. It was nearly a year ago. That our church family was rocked by the death of our friend and our pastor, Bill. We could spend the rest of our days trying to figure out what happened, trying to get answers for why. And somehow we think that if we have answers, it may bring us some comfort. No answers are going to bring him back. His death has left a void in his family, in our church family, in the local community, and the church around the world. God created Bill uniquely, wonderfully, and I think we would agree there'll never be another one like him. And I miss him so much. I wish it weren't this way. The 3 or 4 times a year that I speak up here, without fail, wherever he was, whatever he was doing, Saturday night I'd get a text message filled with encouragement and love. Go get them from Bill. I shared that in first service, and I had more than one person who came up to me and said, I got those too. I didn't get one last night. I missed that. I missed that. Although it might not seem like it to you today, your circumstances will change. God has promised us, and God keeps his promises. God has promised that wherever we go, whatever we're going through, we will not be alone. Deuteronomy 31:6, be strong, be courageous. Do not be afraid or tremble at them, for the Lord your God is the one who goes with you. Listen to this last part. He will not fail you or forsake you. In the midst of his depression, in the midst of his tiredness and his fear, in the midst of losing his focus, in the midst of losing fellowship, God comes to Elijah. Not with a, hey, knock it off. Come on, pull up your bootstraps. We got work to do. God comes to him and he feeds him, restores him physically. And one thing that we could take away from God's conversation with Elijah here, God didn't tell. He asked. Elijah, what are you doing here? Do you think God didn't know what Elijah was doing there? Elijah, what are you doing here? Gives chance for Elijah to just tell it. It's all my pain. Man, I've done all of this, and look what I'm getting for it. You want to kill me, God? And I'm the last one left. And what does God do? I love this. I love this. God says, Elijah, I'm going to remind you of who I am. And through strong wind and earthquake and big, loud, noisy demonstration of power, God shows him all that. But over and over and over, it says, God wasn't in that. God wasn't in that. God wasn't in that. He did it. He showed him. But where did God show up? In a still, small voice. And for you and for me, that's how God works. Yes, he does big things. Yes, we get to enjoy the mountaintop. But the day in and the day out, when we're tired, when we're afraid, when we've lost fellowship, and we're sure we are the only ones in the world going through this, God whispers and says, I've not left you. I'm still here. We're not finished yet. He will do the same for you. I am confident of my God will do the same for you. He still speaks in that same voice. Depression is real. It's a thing. If you're living with someone who is going through it, may I pull on you this morning and ask you to continue to be supportive? Make the conscious choice to step up again today. I know you're tired. But if you're a caretaker, you have got to take care of yourself. Step up again. If you're here this morning and you're experiencing depression yourself, you may feel like somehow you failed or that life has failed you. I want to tell you something. There is no shame in what you're experiencing. There's no head wagging, finger pointing. There is no shame in what you're experiencing. It is real. I knew going into this message that it was going to touch on some difficult and sensitive material. And the reason I say that is I had like this recurring thought in my mind as I'm prepping. I envisioned people who were hearing it saying back to me, yeah, but, you don't know my story. Yeah, but, you just don't. You're right. I don't. I don't know your story. You do. And it is your story. But I can tell you that much like you and your families, anxiety and depression has been and is a part of my family every day. Every day. And I've seen family members who embrace it and they run to God with it and they allow the work of God in their life. And without fail, I have seen those who have run from God. And I can tell you this morning that those who have chosen to run to God instead of away from Him, they stay in the battle. They help to rescue others. They are in a place of surrender, not to fear, but to the one who fights their battles. I'm going to ask Joe to come this morning. He has a little more information to share with you. But as he's making his way, please, this morning, I'm not just asking. I'm begging you, on behalf of your church family, your friends, your colleagues, if you are struggling, if you're to the point this morning where you're ready to say, I am done, Lord, take my life, please seek help. Don't wait. There are resources available. There are people available. And Joe wants to tell us more about that.
Thank you, Mitch. Well, let's take this message. The Word of God is for us to apply to our own life, to our own story, right? This is God's rescue plan for us. So let's make this message a little bit personal for us. Here, maybe you've never been able to put words to your own feelings of depression, but here are some signs and symptoms that could indicate that you may be struggling with this. If you're struggling with sleep, either you want to sleep all the time or you have great difficulty falling asleep and remaining asleep. Things that you once found very pleasurable and enjoyable no longer have the same appeal to you, and you seem to have lost interest in them. or you carry a great deal of guilt for your life and heavy, heavy sense of responsibility. Your energy has changed. Where you once were vivacious and full of life, you now just don't seem to have the energy, even to do some of the most basic tasks of life, like taking a shower, seems like a major accomplishment. Difficulty concentrating, or you've seen your appetite change, where you eat a lot more than you normally would have, and you begin rapid weight gain, or the opposite of where you just lost pleasure in food, and you've seen a rapid decrease in your weight. And then, of course, thoughts of suicide and would the world be better without me? These are all the body's God-given warning alarms to tell us that our souls and our bodies are facing the battle of depression. Listen to those alarm bells that God has given us, because this is a message of hope today. I encourage you today to read chapter 19 of 1 Kings, the rest of the story of Elijah. It's a message of hope. Elijah was ready to die, but that was not God's plan. And I've never had angels cook me breakfast and restore me back to health. But just like Elijah, I have felt God's presence and rescuing in the worst of my moments. And I know many, many of you have as well. And in fact, I want to issue a personal challenge to every one of us in our body. And it's twofold. One is that if you are battling depression, then your number one task is to talk to people about it. Talk to God about it, and then talk to someone else about it. Because as long as it stays within the privacy of your own mind, as long as it stays in the confines of your own heart, depression will continue to suck you into its vortex. But once you verbalize it and get it outside of your help, then someone who is not struggling with what you are struggling with has the strength to help you act in your own self-interest, which is one of the most worst things about depression, is its difficulty for you to do what you know you need to do. And if you do not have depression, God has given you health for the sake of being His agent of healing in the lives of other people, to enter into their story, to listen compassionately, to be proactive. And when you see something, you ask the questions that are hard to ask for the sake of drawing someone else closer to Jesus and closer to the help and hope that they desperately crave. We can do that, right, church? One of the reasons that God gifted us with the church is so that no one would feel alone. So we're going to enter into a time of worship, and we're a praying church. And we're going to ask you, either side of that two-sided coin of changing, of the challenge, is if this is your battle, come and pray, lift that to God, and there will be people who will come alongside you and pray. There's no shame in that. If this is not you, but you know someone, and we all do, then we seek the Lord and ask God to help us. And, you know, it's not a show. It's not a thing that we do for attention. But it is just like Elijah in his moment of isolation said, God, I'm the only one left. Take me out. And God says to him just what he needed to hear. No, you need to know. I've reserved 7,000 just like you, who have never bent their knee to an idol, and you need to stand up, leave the cave, and go get a glimpse of what remains. So we pray corporately for one another. We surround one so you will know on a personal level that you are not alone. So let's stand and worship, and as we stand, if you desire prayer, you want to lift someone else in prayer, start making your way forward, because we as a church can go to our God and rescuer, our great physician, and ask for his healing. One of the ways we worship is to be honest with God about where we are, because when we're honest with God, we acknowledge that He is greater than what we're honest about. And so let's do that this morning as we go to the Lord in worship.